You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Whenever there's a mass shooting at a school, we hear talk about mental health, the need to identify troubled kids and get them into the mental health system before something terrible happens. Well, today we're going to hear from a Michigan mother who tried to do that. She tried to find help for her son, but there was little help to be found, and now her son is in prison for stabbing someone. When Paula Reeves first noticed that her son David was having problems as a young child, she says she sought professional help immediately.
Ultimately, at a young age, she was diagnosed with an emerging bipolar 1 disorder, which is very serious. And he was treated with Trileptal, and that he did respond to that medication very well. And it calmed him down significantly. He was able to focus, but then he would stop taking it.
Which is such a common theme that you hear.
It is.
You start feeling better, so you stop taking the meds.
That's right.
And this, did this pretty much continue through high school?
It did continue, and I wasn't really sure what was going on. There was a time when he was about 12 years old when I would come home and I noticed that there were, inside of the closet on the walls, there would be these holes, and there was no one there with me at that time, so it was as though he had taken a hammer and punched a hole into the wall. And I look back on that. I didn't know what that meant at the time, but I looked back on that, and I think he was having probably some form of delusions that I wasn't aware of.
What was it like navigating the mental health care system?
What mental health care system? We have a mockery of a system. I think that's probably true in all the states, but most of my experience has been here in the state of Michigan. And Michigan, when I've tried to get help for him, it's very sparse, and it's very difficult to get. And it isn't long enough on an outpatient basis, and it isn't long enough on a residential basis to stabilize a person. And there's very few places someone like my son could actually find reprieve and also get supports in place and have appropriate supports in place for someone like him.
As we talk now, your son is in prison. He got a sentence of 15 to 40 years in 2017. Tell us what happened.
He was sentenced because in 2015, he started to threaten me. And before that, he was making threats also to his father. He was beginning to frighten me. He was at a stage where he was just not doing well at all. And he was threatening to shoot me in the head with a gun. At that point, I left the home and I pulled down the petitions for involuntary commitment for the state of Michigan. And I had, by the way, asked David previously and said to him, you know, would you please go see somebody? Would you go in and see if we can get your medication checked? Would you go voluntarily? And he wasn't going to do it. Absolutely not.
The ducks were lining up in a row, in a sense. He'd refused help.
That's right.
He was threatening you, threatening to shoot you in the head.
That's right.
So you pulled down the petition for involuntary commitment.
Yes.
What happened?
I filled it out, and this one was an unusually long, detailed petition. It was 5 pages. Normally, I try to put as little as possible into them, but it was so serious that I wrote some of the threats that he was making to me, and then I had his father forward the texts that my son was making to his father where he said he was going to, quote, slaughter his father. And he thought his father and I were Nazis, and he wanted us to apologize for our wrongdoings. Clearly psychotic behavior. So I went to the court, filed a petition. It was granted. My son was picked up by a local police officer, and he was had a security check. And then he was driven by the officer, who I knew and who also knew my son, to a place called Common Ground in Pontiac. And that is a facility where my son was to be evaluated.
All right, so this is like step one. What happened there?
I went over to the facility after I knew that he was dropped off. And someone finally came out, a social worker, I believe, and we went back and talked in a room, and she wanted to know what was going on. And I said, you know, my son is going to hurt someone if he's not hospitalized right away and medicated. Then I got a call from a police officer, and the police officer was asking me some questions about my son, and then the facility had told me that my son had been arrested for stabbing somebody. My son had either located a 3-inch knife, a folding knife, inside the facility, or he had brought it in. No one knows for sure.
And so that's what landed him in prison with his sentence for stabbing this worker.
Yes, it was a janitor that he stabbed, and she was taken out in a stretcher. She did survive, thankfully, but he was charged with intent to commit murder and possession of a weapon, in this case, a 3-inch knife.
And how long was he in jail awaiting the outcome of this case?
Over 2 years.
And what was it like there for him? Was he getting any kind of treatment, any kind of help that you could see?
He sat in jail for 2 years, almost always without treatment. So what happened during that period of time was he was moved eventually from the mental health wing to a more general population. And within, I think, 24, 48 hours, someone had split my son's head open. And then my son, because he was floridly psychotic, started making phone calls to the district judges and started saying ethnically inappropriate things and trying to threaten them and intimidate them and so on. And he eventually picked up an ethnic intimidation charge in his state of psychosis. And then he was put into isolation, which means in the jail, from his description, it was a cement block room about the size of a small bathroom. And he had nothing to do all day. He was pacing back and forth, and he became more and more psychotic and more out of control.
Could you visit him?
No. Eventually, they cut off my visits also.
And so he gets this sentence under this plea of guilty but mentally ill. What did that mean for David?
That plea of guilty but mentally ill meant that my son could formulate intent to harm someone, and he was found responsible for his crime, therefore, but mentally ill. That plea sent him to prison.
What is his life in prison like now?
It isn't good. He's despondent. Again, I can't see where he is, but I had him describe it to me because I wanted to be clear about where he was. It's a cement block room, and he's in what they call a residential area. It's with other prisoners who have serious mental health disorders like him. And he is on a medication which has allowed him to function, because in prison versus in jail, if you're found guilty but mentally ill, they mandatorily have to give you the medications. He can't refuse it. But he just feels hopeless. He feels that he's never going to get out.
How would you like to have seen things play out for your son, given that he nearly killed someone?
My son should have been found clearly not guilty by reason of insanity. And what the public does not know about that particular verdict is that you go into a secure environment at the Forensic Center where there are security guards. Some of the security guards also work in the prison across the street, which is Huron Valley. So they're very well trained. But they're also very well trained in psychiatric disorders. They understand them. They've had training on site. And the doctors are incredibly well trained, and they have available to them much better medications, and the programs are thorough, and they're geared towards humanely treating but also securing the person that's in the forensic center. So it's not really, calling it not guilty really is probably a misnomer, but the jury again doesn't know if they hear those facts. They hear not guilty and they think, well, they're going to get out, but that isn't at all what happens. They end up sometimes staying much longer at the forensic center than even in a prison setting.
Whenever there is another story in the news about a mass shooter, immediately we hear some of our elected officials calling them crazy and saying we need to look at dealing with mental health issues, I'm doing air quotes here, and take guns away from people who are mentally ill. How does that make you feel when you hear that response?
It makes me feel like we have absolute idiots at the helm of the ship. This is the 21st century. We have science proving that what we call mental is actually a physical disorder of the brain. We used to make fun of people with developmental disabilities. We made fun of people that showed symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. We would call them crazy, mentally ill, so on and so forth. Any kind of the 16 or so different types of dementia, we did the same thing. We thought they were, quote, insane at the end of their lives. Nancy Reagan put the face of Alzheimer's in the public with Ronald Reagan, and we now don't hear those kind of name calling. Forrest Gump, the movie, put the face of developmental disabilities in the face of the public. We still call people who have schizophrenia, even though there's so much evidence to the contrary, crazy, insane, monsters. How do we get laws in place and funding for mental health services if we don't have our top leaders, our policymakers, understanding and educated about these issues?
Paula Reeves, we want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your son's story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We turn now to Michael Perlin. He's professor emeritus at New York Law School, the founding director of the International Mental Disability Law Reform Project, and he's co-founder of Mental Disability Law and Policy Associates. Professor Michael Perlin, welcome to the program.
And I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
So let's break down, first of all, the differences between guilty but mentally ill and not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, what does it mean when you're found not guilty by reason of insanity?
When you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, means you committed the act that would be a crime if you were, quote, responsible for it. In most jurisdictions, it means you are not able to know, quote, right from wrong. And that definition has been with us for 170 years.
Let's go now to how it differs from being found guilty but mentally ill.
If you're found guilty but mentally ill, what that means is you are guilty, you were mentally ill, and you did not meet the statutory standard in that jurisdiction, and you were not, quote, legally insane of the crime in question.
Okay. And this guilty but mentally ill verdict actually does have roots in Michigan. How did it come about?
That's correct. In 1975 in Michigan, there was a 1974 decision called People versus McQuillan. And McQuillan said the mere fact that somebody was found not guilty by reason of insanity did not mean in and of itself he had to be committed to a maximum security facility. And one of the people after the McQuillan case was decided who had been found NGRI, who was released, was charged with committing another crime. So as a reflection of legislative dissatisfaction with and the public outcry over the McQuillan decision, the legislature created the verdict to, quote, and I'm quoting directly from a case called Seafeld, a 1980 Michigan case, to protect the public from violence inflicted by persons with mental ailments who slip through the cracks of the criminal justice system. Now, what's interesting is three states adopted GBMI after Michigan within the next year or two, but it wasn't until the verdict in the John Hinckley case. Hinckley's the guy who was found NGRI not guilty by reason of insanity for shooting President Reagan, mm-hmm. that other states adopted the GBMI verdict. I'm on record as saying I think the verdict is a fraud. And I think it's especially pernicious because you build false hopes. It misleads offenders. It misleads the public. It misleads courts. It misleads defense attorneys who believe that GBMI defendants are accorded some kind of special post-conviction treatment. They are not.
And what do the statistics show, Michael, in terms of length of sentences compared to someone who's just found guilty versus guilty but mentally ill?
Well, we know this. We know any time mental illness is raised in a case, whether you are successful or not, you spend more time locked up than if it is not raised.
And so why do we have this?
We have it so legislators think they're doing something. Legislators thought this was going to reduce the, quote, huge number of jury verdicts, which is totally dead wrong. Here are the statistics. In 1/120th of 1% of all cases, is there a successful contested insanity defense?
Michael, in your view, what is the better way, the best way that we should be handling people who, you know, have mental illness, have committed some offense, they're caught up in the criminal justice system? What should we be doing better?
I have two separate sets of answers to that. One set is those people who are, quote, caught up in the criminal justice system, but who never should have been arrested in the first place. There are cases in which a person is charged with something like failure to give a good account of himself, avoiding arrest, not responding to an officer's inquiry. And they wind up going on this shuttle system from street to jail to hospital to street, repeat cycle. These people should not go into the criminal justice system at all in the first place. These people should be diverted to the mental health system. And we know that when jurisdictions follow what is called the Memphis model, since that's the first place it happened, and police are trained in how to deal with people presenting like this, that arrest rates go down and those problems are really significantly alleviated. On the other hand, a very, very small percentage of people who commit violent crimes have serious mental illness. It is statistically almost insignificant. But again, we hear about it, we know about it, it bothers us. I mean, I remember back in law school when we read about the insanity defense, I remember reading a philosopher's writing, and this has stuck with me, I graduated law school a long time ago, saying one of the reasons why we, the public, doesn't like the insanity defense is that we are good boys and girls. But sometimes the fact that some people seem to be, quote, getting away with it, end quote, really, really riles us because we're good and they're not. They kind of gave in to base impulses, not for a minute understanding that people act in many ways because their mind is working very different ways than yours and mine are, that it's not kind of an optional choice. I believe those people, to answer your question, should be given authentic mental health treatment. I don't know whether authentic mental health treatment can actually be given in prison. Can it be given in hospitals? I think, yeah, to some extent it can be for people who present as you just described. But I think they need to be completely rethought. And I think there's lots of very, very smart people out there, people who study these things, who could come up with blueprints for what would work, what would a maximum security hospital for people who have committed serious dangerous acts, what would it look like? But they're not going to go anywhere. It's not going to fly because legislators are afraid of being, you guessed it, soft on crime. And this simply will not happen. So we're stuck with what we have. This sounds very nihilistic, I'm afraid, but I guess to some extent it is.
Michael Perlin, New York Law School, also the founding director of the International Mental Disability Law Reform Project and co-founder of Mental Disability Law and Policy Associates. Thank you so much for being with us today, Michael. It was great to talk with you.
It was great talking to you.